You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
95BFM Democracy Cares.
At its core, the end-of-life choice referendum is asking voters to make a moral call. And this is why it's being done as a referendum, so that this value judgment is made by citizens rather than by MPs. And I can personally say that as I started thinking about the referendum and talking about it with friends, family members, I found that both sides carry their own ethical conundrums, and that there are so many ethical conundrums involved in this. And I think that this is especially the case in a culture that generally isn't so comfortable talking about death. It's also a very important decision that we're being asked to make here. So I think that developing our own thoughts on the referendum, you know, deciding not just how we want to vote, but why we have reached that decision is crucial. I thought a great person to speak to about this would be a philosopher, someone who wouldn't provide me with a clear answer, but rather someone who would bring more questions, and in doing so, prompt us to think more deeply about our vote. I spoke to Dr. Vanya Kovac, who teaches ethics in the philosophy department at the University of Auckland. I started by asking her why this is so controversial.
Well, I think in part it's because people have so many different views about this. There's quite strong views on both sides, on the pro and against side, but also because it's a really important question. And it's important whichever side you take on this. So for those who are pro-euthanasia, it's really important because of the suffering, the huge suffering that they're trying to prevent for so many people. And, of course, for the other side, it's really important because it seems to be all about their kind of concept of the value of life. And also it's a big responsibility for voters to have to make this decision.
A lot of pro-arguments focus on relieving the suffering of a terminally ill individual and of their family who have to watch them suffer. What are these sort of quality of life arguments appealing to?
Well, I think that certainly sometimes at the very end of life with people who have terminal conditions, there's a lot of pain, and sometimes that pain cannot be addressed with standard pain relievers. On top of that as well, the suffering that comes with loss of function and loss of ability to communicate and loss of dignity is really important for a lot of people. In fact, in certain places where euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide is legal, most people actually claim it's not the pain, it's not the physical pain in particular, that's their reason for requesting euthanasia, but it's that sort of more global sense of suffering, which is to do with loss of capacity. But I think the compassion argument, I think, calls on, you know, something that we all share, which is this desire to, you know, to look after our fellow human being and to reduce their suffering. But I think there's a kind of a thing that comes before the compassion argument, which is quite important, and that is it only makes sense to be compassionate if you, you know, it only makes sense to kill out of compassion if you've already worked out that it's not unjust to kill that person. And I think one of the things that we need to kind of be explicit about in relation to euthanasia is that when someone requests euthanasia, they are waiving their normal right to life. They're saying, I no longer want people to respect my right to life. I'm letting them off. I'm letting this particular doctor off that duty of not killing me and preserving my life. So just in the same way that I can waive my right to privacy and stick a webcam in my kitchen, I can, according to some people, waive my right to life. And once I've waived my right to life, it's not unjust to kill me, and that's the point at which compassion starts to make a lot of sense as a justification for ending someone's life.
It's commonly accepted that animals in pain should be put down. Why do we think of human beings differently?
Well, lots of reasons, I think. Many people think that there's a big divide between animals and humans, and that humans have not only a greater degree of capacity than other animals do, but also that they have the dignity that comes with being an autonomous being that can make their own choices, that the relationships we have are tremendously important. And of course, some people believe that humans have souls and a spiritual side that animals don't have. And so the comparison between euthanizing animals and euthanizing humans is nearly always kind of put forward as we do it to animals, why don't we do it to humans as well? And I think the answer is, for many people, is because that there's a kind of sanctity of human life. On the other side, though, I think it's important to notice that there are kind of reasons to think that this argument should go the other way, because humans can choose when they want to die, and animals can't. We impose it on them. And humans can prepare for death, and animals can't when we impose euthanasia on them. So to me, that comparison isn't as straightforward as you might think.
The Act doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? It exists within the context of a wider health system, and New Zealand's health system has been strongly criticised as being very inequitable. What implications does this have for euthanasia?
I think this is one of the really serious questions, actually, about euthanasia. So, I mean, at the moment we have a system which is inequitable. So, in particular, Māori are disadvantaged by our system. They're disadvantaged through their lack of access, both geographically and also culturally, lack of access to the system. They have slower diagnosis. Overall, they have less access to treatment. And so the result of all of this might be that certain members of our community might kind of find themselves in a position where euthanasia kind of looks very attractive just because of the ways in which the health system has failed them. And I know that some people believe that, euthanasia kind of might be acceptable, but only under certain conditions. You might think it's acceptable if, right, we had a free healthcare system and we had full access to healthcare and we had no discrimination in the health system, and also if we had really excellent, freely available palliative care. And I think for many people, if all of those things were true, well, actually for some people, if all of those things were true, they might feel differently about bringing the Act into force. I think on the other hand, what people are going to say on the other side is something like, well, but that's going to take years to achieve, and in the meantime, there are people who are suffering at the ends of their lives who would be, you know, greatly relieved and advantaged by the Act passing.
The bill only covers people with terminal illnesses who have 6 months left to live. Is there a difference between killing someone and letting them die?
I think people often intuitively think that there's something a lot worse about killing someone than letting them die. And at the risk of being an annoying philosopher, let me give you a couple of examples that I think show that's not true. If you invite someone around to dinner what you want to do is poison them and kill them, but they take a bite of apple as they walk in the door and choke on it, and you don't bang them on the back of the on their back to stop them from choking to death, you've let them die. But actually, the fact that you've let them die doesn't really matter. What really matters is the fact that you wanted to kill them in the first place. Now, the reason why I'm giving you this example is I just think that what really matters in the difference between killing and letting die is what you are trying to achieve. And if someone's life comes to an end, either by allowing them to die or by killing, it's usually not whether it's an act or an omission that makes a difference. It's what your intention is and what the ultimate effect is as well. But I should say, I think in relation to effects, that there can be very different effects of letting someone die of their illness and killing them through an act of euthanasia. Killing someone through an act of euthanasia has lots of other effects, like there are other people involved. There's the doctor, there are the other attendant health professionals. The family, who knows which way they're going to go? Some families will go, I'm so glad that I was able to be with mum or dad the whole time through their decline. And others will say, I'm so glad that mum or dad didn't have to live through that. So I think the intention is really important, what we are trying to achieve, and the effect is also really important. And the fact of whether or not it's a killing or a letting die is kind of not the most morally important thing here. It's what we want to achieve. And whether or not that thing we're trying to achieve is something that's a kind of morally acceptable thing to try and achieve.
You mentioned choice earlier. Does the patient's consent to their own death override all of these arguments that we've just talked about?
So two ways to think about this. One is to think that choice and consent is really important when you're trying to work out who should be eligible for euthanasia. So as it is in the Act, it's only people who are autonomous and fully informed who can consent, and over a certain age and resident in New Zealand, et cetera, right. Their consent alone isn't enough. They also have to have the support of the doctors. So consent and choice is really important in terms of if the Act comes into force, who gets to be able to do it. But I think the other thing is that this idea of choice is a really important argument for those who are pro-euthanasia. So I think in general, the argument goes something like this. Whereas we live in a sort of liberal Western democracy, one of the kind of guiding ideas of this liberal society is that people are allowed to make up their own decisions about how they want to live their lives, and that they should not be interfered with by other people. We've all got our own conceptions of the good life, right? And unless we harm another person in our pursuit of our own idea of the good life, then in a liberal society we should be allowed to do that. So one way to see the choice argument for euthanasia is to see that we also all have different conceptions of the good death, right? And for some people, the good death is dying naturally. And for other people, perhaps the good death is one that is quick and painless and comes at a time of their choosing. The big difference, though, the big difference between our kind of general right in a liberal society to live our lives as we wish and a right to euthanasia is that the right to live our lives as we wish is normally leads to just a duty for other people not to interfere with our choices. However, a right to euthanasia is actually much more substantial in a sense, because it's not just a right to just like organise our own death if we can. It's a right that other people create a system and provide willing doctors who will help us carry out our conception of the good death, right? So the Act proceeds on the assumption that there will indeed be willing doctors, and it is very careful to show that there is an absolute right of conscientious objection and that no doctor has to be part of a process of euthanasia. They do have to refer you to someone, though, however, who is able to help, and that is exactly analogous with the legislation around terminations of pregnancy. No doctor has to perform an abortion, but they do have to refer you on. But I do understand, however, that some doctors feel that even being required to refer is violating their own right to maintain their own moral integrity in relation to their values. So I think that's still an interesting question. You know, is no doctor has to take part if they don't want to, except to refer. But for some doctors, it may be that requirement to refer actually is going over the line for them.
Can you address the slippery slope argument?
Yes. So that is it's quite a common argument that people give, and basically it goes something like, maybe it's okay to have voluntary euthanasia with full consent from adults who are 6 months away from death and suffering unendurably, which is what there is in the Act, right? But if we accept that, then what is going to happen is that some years down the track, we're going to extend this to people who are maybe a year or 2 years from their death, right, or people who are under the age of 18, or people who suffer not from terminal disease but just incurable disease, or maybe disability. And it's very interesting to note that, in a sense, this is kind of what has happened in the Netherlands. So the first euthanasia legislation came in the Netherlands in 2002, and since then they have extended their provisions quite dramatically. So they now have euthanasia for newborn babies, for adolescents, for people on grounds of mental illness only, and also most recently for people in the early stages of dementia. An interesting contrast to this is Oregon, where since 1997 they've had physician-assisted suicide, which is a bit different from active euthanasia. That's when the doctor prescribes you a lethal medication and you go home and you take it whenever you want to. Two things that are interesting about Oregon. The first is in relation to slippery slope argument. There's been no expansion of this at all. So for the last 23 years, the situation in Oregon has remained exactly the same, right? There's been no extension of any of the provisions, right? So they have been utterly stable, whereas in the Netherlands, they have changed their legislation and widened their scope of eligibility quite a lot. I should say that for some people, what's happened in the Netherlands is a kind of slippery slope to a dreadful moral situation, whereas for other people, it's an appropriate extension of legislation to help others. So again, very difficult to kind of run this argument without seeing that there are two quite different ways of seeing what's going on. The final interesting thing about Oregon is that, and I don't know whether or not what people will make of this, is that the people that go home with the lethal medications to take them, only 40% of them actually take it in the end. Can I say one more thing? There's one argument that we haven't looked at, and this comes from a particular philosopher called Velleman, and what he argues is a lot of people say that, you know, if we make euthanasia legal, then it's just a choice that we have, right? And you can choose it if you want to or not choose it. His claim, however, is that it's not always a good thing to have more choices. So his view is that if you don't have the choice for euthanasia, then you kind of stay alive by default. But if you do have the choice of euthanasia, then all of a sudden, if you are in this situation at the end of your life, you then have to justify staying alive. So I think he makes an interesting point here about kind of internal dialogues people might engage in if there is an option to end their lives legally. I've always been interested and intrigued by that argument. I don't think it settles it either way, because I think what we're talking about is two harms. The harm of having to justify or even consider the possibility of ending your life, and the harm of not having an option to do this painlessly and legally.
95 BFM News Election Coverage 2020, Health and Referendums.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.